My name is Jasper B. Shannon. I was born on June the 15th, 1903, in the rural area of Kentucky, about 30 miles from Lexington. My father was 75 when I was born, and my mother 38. Both had had previous families, so that I'm an only child of older parents. My father died in 1911, and I was left a small legacy of $1,500, which had to pay for my high school and college education. Accordingly, this explains why I took some shorter work in summer school to finish my college degree. I was graduated with honors from the Carlisle High School in 1922. I entered Transylvania College that fall on a scholarship program.
Go ahead.
I finished Transylvania in 3 years by going to summer school of 1923 and 1924 at the University of Kentucky. I majored in history and English. I took one course in political science, which was all that was offered. There I became acquainted with the textbook in American government written by Professor Ogg and Professor Ray. This was a factor which led me to go to the University of Wisconsin. The other factor was partisan politics. My father lived during the Civil War. He was a Whig and then a Republican. And one of my uncles fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. Hence, I grew up in a Republican minority party inside a county and a state which was predominantly Democratic. This presented some problems along the race line. As a schoolboy, I was taunted with sleeping with Negroes because I was in the Republican Party. But soon after I entered college, I became disillusioned with the Republican Party under Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge. Hence, I turned to Robert La Follette as the progressive leader in 1924, where I cast my first vote for him in that year. Robert M. La Follette and Frederick A. Ogg, accordingly, were the chief factors that drew me to the University of Wisconsin. I taught in high school at Cynthiana, Kentucky during the year 25 and 26. In June 1926, I made my first trip by train overnight without sleeping accommodations to Madison, coming in on the old Milwaukee Road. At first, I felt weary and tired, but I was able to find a boarding house in a small cottage on the afternoon after my arrival, and so I was able to go on to the university the next day. I had already had some correspondence with some of the instructors. They had sent me bibliographies on the courses in American political theory and international relations, under a plan that was then going to induce people to read before they arrived at the university. I hadn't done very much reading, and they were not surprised. My first course in world politics was a course in international relations taught by Walter Sharp. He was a veteran of World War I, and we had, by 1926, entered a period of great disillusionment with American participation in this war. I remember I was surprised, even shocked, by reading Harry Elmer Barnes's The Genesis of World War I. I can recall that Professor Sharp was very definite in his statements that he did not expect to be trapped into another war. Some of the graduate students had real conflicts over the World War I and the Barnes book. I can recall standing at the foot of Bascom Ridge or Bascom campus and having a heated argument between two men, one of whom was of Spanish ancestry. He had lost an arm during the war, and he did not take kindly to the idea that the war was not fought for good and sound reasons. The other course in international relations was one in American foreign policy taught by Pitman B. Potter, who, in my judgment, was one of the greatest seminar teachers in the country. I can recall very well writing on the foundations of American foreign policy and using a manuscript which he himself had written to be published in the American Journal of International Law. The seminar was held in the library in a spatial political science seminar room on the first floor. This was perfectly adequate, and we had a large and sufficient library. South Hall was another story. It was an old building, and the furnishings were not extremely new. As a matter of fact, they weren't more than barely adequate. The class I had in political theory was with Alan Saunders, who taught in Bascom Hall. I can remember very definitely that Glenn Frank was chosen president of the university that summer and made his opening address to the summer school students. He was introduced facetiously as Mr. Glenn Frank, president of the University of Wisconsin. This was at the time when his oratory was at its height, and along with other graduate students in political science, we were overwhelmed by the magnificence of his oratorical performance. In the class in political theory, the question arose whether Glenn Frank himself had a political theory or not, and Professor Saunders quite frankly said he was willing to debate the question. This enamored me with the openness and candor of the University of Wisconsin campus, and soon I read the emblazoned bronze statement about the winnowing that had to go on at Wisconsin and without regard to its consequences. And this became a part of my traditional Wisconsin loyalty. The summer school lasted only 6 weeks, and I was generally satisfied with the work that I had. My record was pretty good. I then entered into that fall an arrangement that the university had permitting people to take graduate work out of residence and come back to the university and take examinations. I wrote Professor Ogg and got back a sort of a double negative answer that they had about decided not to allow it anymore, but in my case they would allow me to do it. So I took international law and constitutional law under Professor Max Repas. I never saw him. I just took his examination the following June. He was very gracious to me. He sent me the notes that he himself had taken at Yale Law School. He sent me a copy of those notes, which were very helpful. And I outlined in the various cases in international and constitutional law during the course of the year 1927. Went back to the university in the summer of 1927. And this would have been 1926-27. I went back in the summer of 1927 and took the examinations. And if I may modestly say so, I passed with flying colors. That year, 27, I had my first courses with Professor Joseph P. Harris. The course was in political parties, a seminar. He had planned to have 15 or 20 students, and he had outlined enough work for the 15 or 20. Unfortunately, he had only 3 students, and we were supposed to do all of the work that he had outlined for the 15. I read all of Walter Lippmann's books, including Public Opinion, and most important of all, Graham Wallace's Human Nature in Politics, and 3 other volumes of his. And this came to be a leading factor in my teaching for the next 50 years. I always used Graham Wallace in Public Opinion as a textbook, although it seemed out of date by many people. I still think it is probably the most significant book in the field of public opinion that has ever been published. We also did studies of various political campaigns, and I did the one on the mayoralty race in Chicago in 1927, in which Big Bill Thompson was running for re-election as mayor. This furnished a sort of model for my writing my dissertation, or my thesis rather, on the governor's election of 1927 in Kentucky. And this I was doing under Professor Harris. He gave me, as a model, a book on the Chicago primaries of 1926, I believe. And I spent the fall of 1927 interviewing people, attending rallies, and collecting material on the gubernatorial election, which oddly enough was based somewhat on the same propaganda theme that they had at the university, had at Chicago in 1926, in which Big Bill Thompson promised to keep King George out of Chicago. And we were going to be sure that King George was going to be hit on the snout and that the textbook in American history would not be permitted. I used that same textbook in high school that fall, and for some coincidental reason, this became a theme of the discussion in the gubernatorial election. The Democratic nominee was a former governor with a very aristocratic sounding name. As a matter of fact, the Republicans took pride in pronouncing it every time as John Kreps Wycliffe Beckham. Whereas the Republican nominee went for the name of plain old Flem from the mountains of Laurel County. The real issue in the campaign was whether horse race gambling should be permitted. Governor Beckham was opposed to it. He had the support of the Louisville Democratic Organization, but the Central Kentucky Organization dissented. And actually, through their support to the Republican nominee. In one of my interviews with a black man, at that time the Republicans had separate headquarters for blacks and whites, and he told me that the Democratic boss, William F. Clair, had already sent over $5,000 that Beckham had sent to him, had sent it over to the Sampson headquarters. The result in the election was the choice of a Republican governor by about 30,000 votes. All the other state officers were Democrats. And what ensued was 4 years of party friction in Kentucky. Well, this material I wrote up in my master's thesis, which I presented in 1928 for my master's degree. I may say that I had one contact with Professor Harris, who was off duty in 1928. He found me on the, passed me on the street near the library at Madison, public library, and he stopped and gave me a warm greeting. When it came to my writing or my oral examination, Professor Harris was not there. In the meantime, there had been a great change in the university, the introduction of the so-called experimental college, locally known as the X College. This had been a proposal that came primarily from President Frank, and he had brought in a new man from the University of Minnesota, Professor John M. Goss. I remember distinctly in the summer of 1927 that Professor Ogg had the graduate students over to the faculty club and gave us a fine lunch, and he was discussing the fact that they were bringing in a new professor and they were going to pay him $5,000 a year, which seemed totally out of proportion to what the ordinary salaries were at the universities. He also told me of the plans that they had for building a new social science building over on Lake Mendota. And he said they had it planned down to the place where they would have soft cushions for the candidates for the PhD degree to sit in during the examination. I don't believe that building has been constructed yet. Let's stop a little bit.
Go ahead.
In 1927, I had my first class with Professor Ogg in European background of American political theory. I actually made an oral report, and by this time I had enough courage even to inject a little humor into it, and was delighted to find out that Professor Ogg was a man who had wit and humor, although he had something of a stammer. But he had overcome that during the years, largely. In the summer of 1927, I ventured out into the field of sociology to take a course with Edward Allsworth Ross, who was the greatest name in sociology in the university and in the field at large. That year he lectured on population problems. Actually, he read chapters from his book that he would publish that fall entitled Standing Room Only. He was very strong on the danger of too many people, and he was paid a number of strictures upon the type of immigrants that came into the United States after 1900. In the class, there was a Jewish rabbi who took some offense at the description which Ross gave of the immigrant people who were coming in. I got very well acquainted with the rabbi, and I can remember him saying to me on one occasion, "If you think the blondes around here are beautiful, I want you to see my wife, who is a Jewish brunette." And he had us to dinner one night, and he did have a beautiful wife. Ross was an emigre, as he called it, from Stanford University. He had been fired at Stanford because of lectures he wrote about Leland Stanford and others recruiting Oriental labor. And then he'd gone to the University of Missouri, and then he'd come on to Wisconsin. He was a huge man. He must have been close to 6'8". He wore a wing collar. He had a bristling mustache. He had an angular face. He was not the most modest man in the world, because he had the habit of dropping names every once in a while, the connections he'd had with Theodore Roosevelt. And he had had Herbert Hoover as a student. And he had been on the athletic board at Stanford, and they were selecting a business manager. And Herbert Hoover and somebody with a name long since forgotten had applied for the job, and he had chosen the other man instead of Herbert Hoover. And he liked to humorously remark that that showed his judgment of character and the possibility that he and Herbert, he said, had an occasional joke about it. That was the first time I got acquainted with another member of the sociology department, a social psychologist, by the name of Kimball Young, who was one of the numerous grandsons of Brigham Young from Utah. And apparently he had a few, at least by rumor, of the traits of his grandfather. I can recall one time they had what they call a sociology dinner about every Friday night. And they spoke, they had somebody in the department to speak. And I recall Kimball Young doing an extraordinary job of dissecting and vivisecting everything that Ross had ever written, indicating that his methodology was totally worthless, that it was purely impressionistic, and had nothing back of it except his own impressions, that he would go somewhere for 6 weeks and then write a book on it. Professor Ross took it in good stead and remarked that this sounded like his methodology and it wasn't any methodology at all. In 1928, I had my first class with Professor John M. Goss. The title of the course was Political Theory and International Relations. We used John Dewey's The Public and Its Problems, which became a sort of Bible with Goss students thereafter. And I included this a part of the structure that I employed in writing my doctoral dissertation later. Professor Goss was not a lecturer. He was primarily a leader of dialogue. And he managed to bring out of his students comments and questions and answers that made them talkative when they were ordinarily too frightened to say anything. He didn't always make a hit with every student. A girl that was from Cincinnati that I had known before went in to see him and explained that she wasn't getting enough out of the course, which miffed him a bit, and he said he wasn't running a cash and carry a drug or grocery store, that what she got out of it was what she put into it. At any rate, from that day on, as long as he lived, I regarded him as my intellectual mentor. And he became the outstanding teacher of political science, and the first and perhaps the only one that there was ever a selected president of the American Political Science Society, because he was a great teacher. Everywhere you met people who had had courses with him, you heard this eloquent description of him. Actually, He was the principal architect of the Experimental College. And there he attempted to bring the students into a critical appraisal of their own community. The first semester, they required all the people to write or study pre-industrial civilization. And they read a lot of the classics on Rome and Greece. And then the second year, they studied their home community and wrote a volume on it, their paper. And this was supposed to give them an insight into the actual forces that operated. Some years later, I was to hear President Michael John, Dean Michael John, or by whatever name he went, say at a discussion of the Experimental College that an intelligent education was impossible in the United States, that people would not permit it because you attacked too many pet institutions. In 1928, I came up for my oral examination, and this I remember very distinctly. It was the toughest hour I ever had. In addition to it, I came up with an infected foot. On about the 26th of July, my examination was to take place on August the 14th. I went over to the health center to get prescriptions for my infected foot, and I came back and got the mail that my oral examination had been moved up to July the 31st. And I recall going home, it was a very, very hot day, and lying down, perspiring upstairs with my foot in hot water to try to get over the infection, at the same time studying international law, which I didn't need at all on the oral examination. The examination took place on July the 31st, and I was subjected to a searching, rigid examination by Walter Sharp, whose point of view was one thing, and John Goss, who was another, and Alan Saunders, I think, was the third. And it was the most uncomfortable hour I've ever spent in my life. If I ever thought I knew anything at the end of that day, I was certain I knew nothing. But whether through graciousness or through kindness or whatever, they passed me, and I was on my way to getting my MA degree. At the same day I was in to consult with Professor Goss, a letter came from the University of Kentucky Political Science Department asking me whether I was interested in accepting a job there, which Professor Harris had taken the first steps to get the university to move on. And so the day after, or 2 days after I passed my oral examination, I got a telegram offering me my first call. In 1928, I ventured into the Department of Economics as part of my minor. I took the class under John R. Commons, the most distinguished economist at the university. He was an entirely different type from Professor Ross in sociology. He was one of the most modest men I ever encountered. We had our little seminar over in the law school. Occasionally he would have to interrupt because he said, "You'll have to excuse me, I took a pill last night." He dug into and had in his the legal foundations of capitalism into the whole background through the courts of the development of the economy. And that summer he first told us, and frightened most of us nearly to death, that he expected us to write an elementary textbook on economics. Fortunately, the other members of the class were about as baffled as I was, so we waited. Finally, he said he was going to be satisfied with an outline of an elementary textbook on economics, and he finally ended up by saying that we could just give an outline of one chapter in a book on economics. He had a long list of cases that somebody had given him the citations for that were in the old English common law reports that went back into the 14th and 15th century. And whoever gave him these reports hadn't been too accurate. So I went down to the law library in the state capitol, and I spent hours and hours getting out volumes that had dust nearly a half an inch thick on them that hadn't been used, I suppose, since they'd been purchased. And I got the correct citations, and I put those in, and I turned them in, and that seemed to please him. I say he was a very modest man. One event stands out in my memory. He was talking about the United States going off the gold standard during the Civil War. I had read Charles A. Beard's book, The Rise of American Civilization, and I remembered that the bankers got paid in gold. And I was bold enough to say that I think everybody but the bankers went off, and he told me I was wrong. But a few days later he came in and he said, "Now boys, one of you said the other day that the bankers didn't go off the gold standard, and I said you were wrong. I looked it up and I was wrong." I was tremendously impressed with a man of the distinguished reputation of John R. Commons to admit to a class that he had made an error. And he stands out in my memory as one of the three or four great professors I ever had. He, according to reputation, would not pass on doctor's examinations because he himself had failed the examination in Johns Hopkins somewhere or other. And he would always say, when it came to the examination, "Let's leave that to Selig." And Selig was Selig Perlman, who was his alter ego in economics. I got to know more about him when I came back to the university some years later. John R. Commons had his Friday nights in which he invited everybody that was a graduate student or interested to come, and we used to go to the YMCA down at the Madison YMCA. And I remember very distinctly some of the speakers he had. One was a woman from Great Britain who had been in the labor movement during the World War, and she'd had dealings with Lloyd George. And I remember her saying that whenever the girls had an agreement with Lloyd George on Saturday afternoon, they would request that he write down what he said because he had a very bad memory. And on Monday morning, he might not remember what he said. Another one had a sort of a personal connotation for me. One of his former graduate students was Edgar Z. Palmer, who was teaching at the University of Kentucky. And he had him in to speak on labor problems, or some of them. And I remember he always referred to him as Easy, because he was Easy Palmer. This about completes my recollections of my master's undergraduate work. I want to comment about Pitman B. Potter. As I said before, he was a great seminar teacher. Later on, we had him to lecture for us in the United States Department of Agriculture Graduate School. He had become dean of the graduate school. A worse selection for dean I cannot imagine, because his memory for detail was never very good. And the last I heard of him, he was in France in an alcoholic institution. And that was because he had made the terrible mistake, which I'll go into later, of going to Geneva instead of going to Harvard.
Yes.
My later connections with the University of Wisconsin were determined by the Depression. I had, for a long time, planned to go to law school. So at the end of the semester in 1929, I resigned as an instructor at the University of Kentucky and made plans to enter the Harvard Law School that fall. I believe I was about the first person in the United States to learn that the Depression was coming on. In the middle of July, I wrote to the Building and Loan Association in Philadelphia, where I had put my savings over the past 4 years, for funds to start me in the law school. To my amazement, I received a letter saying they had insufficient funds to pay me at that time. Accordingly, I entered Harvard in the fall of 1925 under very cloudy circumstances, for I had to borrow money to even pay the expenses of the train trip. Then came the Depression in October, and I had an opportunity of hearing the discussion of financial problems in the law school and in the press in Boston. Suffice it to say that I did receive about a third of what I had saved in the Building and Loan Association. But by the end of February, they wrote me that they would have no further funds. So all of this was lost. Accordingly, I turned back toward the academic profession. I had a contract to teach at the University of Kentucky during the summer of 1930, and I likewise was engaged to teach at the University of Akron during the following year. But under unusual circumstances, I was suddenly offered the job in political science and history at Transylvania University, my alma mater. This made it possible for me to stay at home and look after my mother, whose health had grown worse during the course of the year. Immediately, I decided that the thing for me to do was to go ahead and get my doctor's degree in political science. Accordingly, in the fall of 1930, I wrote to Professor Ogg about the following year. To my surprise, Professor Joseph Harris had left, and the new man was Professor John T. Salter. This led to a long time association with him, although never in classroom. I was too late for any sort of graduate assistantship, but I was granted a legislative fellowship, which meant that my out-of-state tuition was all paid, so I could enter the university in the summer of 1931 without paying out-of-state tuition. In the summer of 1931, I took political theory with a young instructor, J. Mark Jacobson. He was not very much older than I was, and he had written a book on American political theory. It had not yet been published. I found him a very interesting young lecturer, and my little legal training stood me in good stead. As a matter of fact, the two of us became friends. When I returned to the university in the fall of 1931, I decided that I should live in the dormitories, especially the new ones that have been built over on Lake Mendota in connection with the experimental college. I made this decision because I had found that living a long way from the campus in Cambridge had led to loneliness and unsatisfactory meals. My association with the dormitories and with the food and with the students, graduate and undergraduate and professional, I found it very pleasant during the year 1931-32. When I registered for the fall, Professor Ogg suggested that I could offer a double minor in law so that I could take advantage of the credits that I had attained in law during the year 1929-30. That fall, I had an extremely heavy load, including 6 hours in the law school, Professor Ogg's two classes, and Professor Goss's class, and in addition to that, a reading course in political leadership with Professor Kimball Young. Professor Ogg was very dubious about me undertaking such a heavy load, but in view of the fact that I had had classes in the law school before and would be repeating some of this work, he rather reluctantly permitted me to go ahead with it. I took Professor Goss's course in political theory, which covered the entire field of European political thought. Professor Ogg suggested that it would be partly a repetition of what I had had under him, but that when I took it under Professor Goss, it would be so different that I wouldn't realize that I'd ever had the same course before. He was correct. Professor Goss now had become probably the most popular teacher in the whole field of political science. His popularity arose from the fact, I think, that he had a personal way of drawing out students in dialogue rather than the lecture method, although his wide reading, the fact that he could quote from so many varied sources, from poetry to politics, made him an extremely eloquent teacher. I recall that we started with Plato's Republic, and I likewise recall that I boldly undertook to write a dialogue on Plato as my term paper. The second semester, I dealt with the political philosophy of Cicero. We were invited to dinner at Professor Goss's home, and I can recall very well his very modest suggestion that I wasn't getting anything out of his course, although it was the most valuable course I was taking. Professor Ogg likewise had a departmental dinner for graduate students. And one of the amusing things that happened was the question over the dispute between the Dean of Women and President Frank. And Mrs. Ogg accidentally suggested that perhaps they had a course in which deans of women could be trained. And Professor Ogg threw up his hands and said, "God forbid that there should ever be a place where we train deans of women." I was very much impressed with Professor Ogg's way of doing business in his home. He had three desks, and one of them he worked as chairman of the Department of Political Science. At the second one, he worked as editor of the American Political Science Review, and the third one, he worked as editor of the Political Science Century book series. So that when he grew weary of one task, he would shift over to another. And his methodical, systematic way of doing things made a profound impression. I did take a course in international organization from Professor Potter. And one of the amusing episodes was when he came down the stairs one day and to his mailbox, and he pulled out an envelope. Holding it up, he said, "Hooray, goddamn money." It was a check that he'd gotten from the International, the Law Journal. It was rather typical of Potter that he was informal and friendly with his students. I managed to get through the law courses. The professor of contract law, whose name I do not remember at the moment.
See if I'm being recorded, and then we'll just let it play a minute.
His great professional rival was the Harvard man who had written a textbook on contracts. This was the textbook we used, but he got our Wisconsin man got great particular pleasure out of pointing out how wrong the man, the author of the textbook, was. I had had the course with the Harvard man, but I managed to get through without too much trouble. There was a great difference between the method of teaching in the law school and in the graduate school. This is illustrated by the fact that one of my close friends in the graduate school took a course in administrative law in the law school, and he attempted to do it as a political scientist would do it. The result was that he got a D in the course, much to his chagrin. On the other hand, having had my legal background, I never let the law professors know that I was a political scientist, but left them with the impression that I was studying law as a lawyer, and I never had any trouble with it. That was a part of the sort of friendly rivalry between political scientists and lawyers. The year 1931 was a decisive one, not only in the United States, but in Great Britain. And I recall very definitely our discussion of the fact that Great Britain went off the gold standard in September 1931, and Professor Goss's comments upon it, as if the underpinning of the whole world had fallen out. He had studied in Great Britain on a social science research fellowship and had written a book on British public opinion and citizenship. He was, in a considerable measure, a devotee of the British way of doing things, although he was not always a believer in British imperialism. During the year 1931-32, the Depression had made its tremendous impact, and the University of Wisconsin was particularly subjected to the cross currents. Philip La Follette was governor, and Robert La Follette was senator. I recall going to the Ohio State football game and seeing these two young men sitting in the bleachers, and I was extremely impressed that these two prominent politicians should receive little attention in Wisconsin as compared with what they would have received in southern states or border states like Kentucky. The friction between Governor La Follette and President Frank grew during the course of the semester, and it involved, among other things, the teaching assistants or graduate assistants who were forming an organization to try to get their meager stipends increased. I think I'm correct in saying that Professor Goss was one of those who contributed to the student organization to help them improve their lot. President Frank was making $25,000 a year as president of the university, and he was likewise writing columns for the newspapers at about a similar sum of $25,000. There were few professors who made above $6,000 or $7,000 a year, and the governor himself was receiving only $7,500. So the lines between the two grew rather strained. Also, in the winter of 1932, Ernie Meyer, who was a columnist for the Capital Times, wrote an article in the American Mercury entitled The Great Glibber, which was a severe criticism of Glenn Frank. His experience as a preacher and as an exhorter led one professor to comment that there was Methodism in his madness. In January, we had a debate at the Student Union among Norman Thomas, Professor Les Cohere, and Scott Nearing on communism, capitalism, and socialism. And I recall distinctly that Scott Nearing, dressed in his worker's garb with top shoes, raised his hand as if in a benediction and said, "God have mercy on your souls because what this generation is going to have to go through." Norman Thomas was the wittiest, as usual, and he said that capitalism was correctly represented by Les Cohere, which was, "Let's go here, let's go there, let's go everywhere." And in the vote that was taken afterward, Norman Thomas won by a great majority the approval of the students. In the spring of 1932, Sumner Slichter, the son of the dean of the graduate school, spoke on the campus. Young Slichter, was a professor of economics at Harvard. This was at the time when economic planning had come into vogue among intellectuals. And I recall that he said on one occasion that he would sooner go out in polite society without his pants than without his plan, because everybody had to have a plan. Also in the spring, Professor Commons delivered a lecture which left a great impression upon me. He said, as an intellectual, he knew that he would be shot by the fascist or by the communist or perhaps by capitalist dictatorship, and hence he could be truly impartial on discussing these various systems of political and economic organization. And I was also attracted by his statement that if the fascists took over, They'd be led by Governor LaFont. If the capitalists took over the dictatorship, they would be led by President Frank, and he supposed Scott Nearing would be the communist dictator. This was an example of complete freedom of discussion on the Madison campus that further impressed me with the uniqueness of the quality of life in Wisconsin. During the course of the year, likewise, the university got into politics because a letter to the Daily Cardinal, presumably written by a co-ed, had raised the question whether virginity was a desirable quality in girls and women. This produced a storm of protest from some house mothers in Madison and out over the state, and got editorial comment. And then on May the 1st, lo and behold, as we crossed the hill, the red flag was flying over Bascom. And the State Journal had a headline on the paper that afternoon, "Red Flag Flies Over Bascom." This disturbed President Frank so much that he called a special convocation of all students, in which he delivered one of his typical orations in making light of the whole thing, saying that in the old days when they used to put a cow upon Bascom Hall, that he presumed the paper would have come out with a headline, "Dairy Industry of Wisconsin is insulted, cow over Bascom." But you could see that there was a very considerable turmoil going on. Then in the spring, something new happened. Russians sent over their first delegation to study at Wisconsin, primarily in the field of planning and engineering. In the dormitories, in the mixture round at the tables, I got thrown with one of the men, and we became acquaintances. Oddly enough, the first thing that he was concerned about was his health. He was having difficulty with the changing of the diet, and I recommended that he go to the student health, and he said he'd been there and it hadn't been satisfactory, and that American medicine wasn't up to the standard of Russian medicine. I gave him a recommendation of a rather common advertised product, and it worked all too effectively. At any rate, during the spring and summer, we began to talk more freely. I recall in June, I believe it was, that he asked me, or he asked to come to my room. He wanted to show me the drawings that he had of the sewer system of Madison. And he also wanted to show me the picture of his wife, who was a very striking, Slavic person. That at the same time that there was disturbance among some of the newspapers and others about communism taking over the sex life of the university. There was a senatorial contest on. John Blaine was an incumbent senator who had been connected with the old progressive movement, and he was running for re-election. And Johnny Chappell, an editor from Ashland, undertook to contest the nomination with Blaine. And what he sought to do was to frighten the people of Wisconsin over the immorality which was going on the Wisconsin campus. He even came to the summer school and took a course in sociology, looking for material to help his campaign. Not too surprisingly, he won the nomination over Blaine, but in the fall, the Democratic trend was so great that he was defeated by a Democrat. for the Senate. And a Democrat was elected the governor of Wisconsin. He was the mayor of Madison. greatly to his surprise, because he hadn't expected to do anything except be the nominal nominee of the Democratic Party. That we'll have a little more on commencement in 1934. Suffice it to say that Wisconsin was a challenging place, that as the Roosevelt campaign of 1932 began to emerge, more and more it seemed as if he were turning to Wisconsin for a model. And the work that Governor La Follette had done in public works, improving the rail, the roads, putting bridges over the highways, and other schemes of public employment, won attention from the Democrats. In the spring of 1932, I took my oral examination in German, and with that burden off, I turned ready for my prelims, which is required in 6 fields. These I took along in May, and I have a very definite impression of the kindness of Pittman B. Potter bringing over my examination questions to the dormitory for me to take, rather than sending it through the campus mail or something of that sort. He had taken over as acting chairman of the department while Professor Ogg was in Washington. Professor Ogg was absent on one occasion for a class in methodology that he was teaching, and he did me the signal honor of asking me to chair the class while he was gone, when there were several of the graduate's assistants around that might have filled in the place. I did my work on the political leadership of the Labor Party, on Ramsay MacDonald and the breakup of the Labor Party, which is one of the most profitable pieces of research I ever did. When I returned from Kentucky in this June of 1932, the Chicago Tribune papers were available, last political conventions are meeting in the United States. This is the end of democracy. I sat up in the union and listened on radio to the entire Democratic convention, which lasted all one night, in which former presidential nominees went to sleep, and on occasion, I suppose, I nodded too. And then came the word that Roosevelt had been chosen by Secretary McAdoo. I recall the conversation I had with Professor Goss just afterward, and how impressed we were with Roosevelt's flying to the convention to accept the nomination, and how he gave the impression of somebody from outer space or from on high, or the outer world, coming in to make his acceptance speech. That summer, I took some work with Professor Grayson Kirk, and again some social psychology with Professor Kimball Young. Professor Kirk was then a very young man, but he was probably the most popular lecturer on the campus. He had been told that because he had a defect in speech that he would never be able to teach. He still had a certain hesitancy in speech, but he was very successful in attracting students and later went on to be president of Columbia University. Professor Young, in the summer of 1932, gave us some advice about going to see Dean Slichter. He said, never go until after 11 o'clock because he has his soda water just before that time, and after that it'd be more amiable. This worked for me perfectly. In the spring, I had gone in to see Dean Slichter, and he had looked over my credentials, and although I had passed my preliminaries and done all my coursework and so on, he decided I'd have to come back for a semester because I didn't have enough residence work. Well, of course, I'd had the residence work at Harvard, and it was a question of getting credit for that resident work. Professor Goss met me in the hall and asked me what was on my mind, and I told him, and he said, I'll write a letter. He wrote the letter saying that the residence was acceptable. With great hesitation, I took it up to Dean Slichter, who had a great reputation for irascibility. Sure enough, he took one look at it and threw it on the ground floor and said, Gauss is a Harvard man. He'd take anything from Harvard. So I met Professor Goss just after that, and he asked me what happened to the letter. I didn't tell him what happened to it exactly, except I said he didn't accept it. And lifting his head haughtily, Professor Goss said, there's some people who are dead and don't know it. Excuse my French, and walked down the hall. And this was my little squabble between the faculty. I went off to, during summer, I wrote to the Harvard Law School and got a statement from them. Slichter said he wouldn't accept that unless it was approved by the law school at Wisconsin. So I took it down to Dean Rundell, who was one of the finest men I ever knew, one of the three or four best law instructors I ever had. And I remember he said, you write out what you want, and I'll sign it. And I wrote it out as stiff as I thought I could and brought it down. And he looked up to me with a twinkle in his eye and said, Dean Slichter's a little hard of hearing sometimes. And he added an extra, stronger statement. And I took it up to see the dean after he'd had his bicarbonate of soda. He was very amiable. He asked me what I wanted him to do with it. And I said, I'd like you to approve my residence. And he got out a little penny pencil about 2 inches long and put his initials on it and then turned around and said, so you're from Transylvania. That's a grand old institution. And we had a conversation for a few minutes that was very pleasant. So my residence was approved. Accordingly, I was getting ready to do my dissertation on Henry Clay, and I wanted to go to Washington. And I got permission from Professor Young to turn in my term paper on Henry Clay after I'd gone to Washington. So I left the university a little early. And in Washington, the Bonus Army had just been run out of the city by General MacArthur and General, or then Major Eisenhower. Washington was a very stifling place, not only because there was no air conditioning then, but because of the tenseness that had arisen over this action by President Hoover and the Army. There was at the time a considerable amount of talk about the Army taking over, and General Smedley Butler had been mentioned, the man who was head of the Marine Corps, had been mentioned as a prospective dictator. But apparently he had no dictatorial intentions at all and refused to have anything to do with it. So in this summer of 1932, I was in Washington when we were observing Governor Franklin Roosevelt holding his hearing on Mayor Walker. And to the surprise of many, including Walter Lippmann, who thought he was an amiable nonentity, he presided like a judge and did a very effective job of it. So this was the end of my graduate of the year attendance at the university. I did not see Professor Salter because he was at that time on the Social Science Research Council scholarship studying politicians in Philadelphia. I met him only once or twice. But in the meantime, Professor Salter was so depressed by the salary he was getting, and he had a wife and four children, I believe, that he sent his wife and children down to Berea, Kentucky, to live in the cheaper marketplace of Berea. I went ahead during 1932-33 with the preparation of my dissertation, and I sent it in to Professor Salter in 1933, and I heard no word from him over a long period of time. This naturally was very disturbing to me because it was holding up the prospect of getting a degree, and the degree was worth something. Finally, in sort of desperation, I prevaricated and wrote him a note saying that my job depended on my getting a degree. He wrote me and said, "Am I holding you up?" Well, I didn't have to tell him. So he sent me on, and I think he left my dissertation on his desk for a year. I had the feeling that he never read all of it, that he may have read the one chapter in it. I think his wife, Mrs. Salter, who was an excellent person in English, had read it and was perhaps helpful. In the meantime, his position in the department had become awkward, and Mrs. Salter had written an article for the Old Scribner's Magazine describing the position of a professor in a department in some college somewhere or other, whose colleagues had no children at all, whereas the one that had several children got no increases in salary. But it didn't take very long for this to create something of a disturbance. Although nothing was said about it openly, we understood pretty soon that Salter would never be promoted, and he never was. He remained an associate professor for the next 30 years. I talked to, or in 1940, I was at a meeting of the Midwestern Association, and Professor Goss asked me to take a walk with him. He had now become chairman of the department, and he asked me about my comments, our thoughts on the department. And I mentioned the fact that Salter kept my dissertation for over a year, and he said, "Why didn't you write me about it?" And I said, "Well, I'm a major professor and student. It was a very delicate situation, and you don't get involved in that if you can keep from it." Well, then he made several comments about Professor Salter that he had, he was rather unhappy because Professor Salter had confined himself entirely to the one subject, and that was leadership. And that was on his book on boss rule in Philadelphia. And that he couldn't get him interested in anything else. He tried to get him interested in reporting, government reporting, and interested in photography and government reporting. But he had been unsuccessful. So I think I can say accurately that from that time on, Professor Salter was in the political science doghouse. And I am not sure of what it had a considerable effect upon my later recommendations, because I had to have him make recommendations in any applications I made for scholarships or anything of that sort. And I feel that the fact that he was in trouble with the profession, not only locally but nationally, may have acted as a handicap. On the other hand, Professor Goss was always the most cordial of friends. And it was only by accident, I suppose, that I had Professor Salter instead of Professor Goss as my major professor. When I wrote in 1930 about what my topic was, Professor Ogg assigned me to Professor Salter. And later on, Professor Goss intimated that maybe I wanted to do the dissertation with him, but I couldn't say it. And this, I think, was acted as a handicap.
Archer.
One or two observations I might make about my 1932 year in Madison. It was the final year of the six-year experimental college. I had an opportunity to meet with some of the students who were finishing their last year. They apparently were deeply affected, both personally and professionally, by this experience. The trouble that led to the end of the experiment was largely in the faculty, especially in the language and mathematics departments, who objected to the nature of the curriculum in the experimental college. As far as I'm personally concerned, I'm inclined to believe that this was the most unusual experiment in higher education in the last half century. Professor Goss was actually the intellectual leader in what was carried on in the experimental college, and students spoke to me glowingly of the personal interviews they had with him. One student reminded me that Professor Goss had what he considered a unique way of terminating an interview. When he'd gotten all from the student, or the student had gotten all from him, that was worthwhile, Professor Goss would stand up, reach up in his library, and pull down a book. And that was the indication it was time for the student to depart. I had completed my dissertation in 1933, but only after the interval which I have already described did I get an affirmative answer from Professor Salter. My oral examination was fixed for June the 1st, 1934. It was an unusual spring in that when I left Kentucky for Madison on May the 25th. The heat was on the Pullman. Within the week that I had given myself to be acclimated to the change from a teacher to a student, the weather changed abruptly. The dust storms came from the west, and on June the 1st, 1934, it was 102 in Madison. I prepared myself for the oral examination by going to a movie the night before. And when I returned to the campus, right next to the library, I met one of my old friends from the economics department. He asked me when I was going to take my oral, and I told him the next day. And then he gave me the illuminating information. Did you hear what happened in the econ department? They were starting the oral examination, started to ask the student a question, and he was absolutely petrified and couldn't say a word, and they had to dismiss the examination. You can imagine what I said to him to get on over the hill and not talk to me again. I prepared for the examination by having lunch, taking a cold shower, lying down in my bed and taking a nap, and then going over to the examination. The most startling thing that happened there was a warrant had to come from the graduate school to have the signatures of the professors when the oral was finished. Lo and behold, Professor Soler had lost it. And he asked me to go up to Dean Slichter's office and get a second copy. With great trepidation, I went up and told the girl what the problem was. And she said, oh, we never do that. We couldn't possibly do anything of the sort. I assumed that my PhD was over. But I said, Professor Salter lost it. She said, oh, I understand. That's perfectly all right. I'll give you another one. And I took it down to Professor Ogg, and he said Professor Salter would do something like that. The oral examination went very smoothly. One of the most heartening things I had was in passing the office Professor Grayson Kirk, and he was talking to somebody else about my dissertation. And I overheard him make the comment, at least this wasn't a dull dissertation. I enjoyed reading it. That gave me certain enthusiasm for starting the oral examination. I had talked to Professor Rundell before about what to be prepared for on law, my double minor in law. And he said, let me put you at ease. I will not ask you a single question. However, he did ask me one question when the problem came, when the matter was mentioned of Henry Clay's having a son who was mentally placed in a mental institution. And he wanted to know why that happened, and wasn't that an explanation of perhaps some of the peculiarities? The answer was no, he was kicked by a horse, and this was what put him in the mental institution. So on June the 1st, 1934, I took my oral examination. It lasted not longer than an hour. It was all a polite exchange. There was no bad things at all, in great contrast to the unhappy experience I'd had in taking my master's oral. I think that had prepared me to do a better job for the doctoral examination. After the examination was over, Professor Salter took me down and gave me some sort of cold drink as a celebration for passing the examination. Afterward, I stayed on the campus until commencement, which occurred on June the 18th, Waterloo Day. I had the dormitory almost entirely to myself, and I spent my time reading fiction. One thing I was startled to find on the explanation of dress for commencement was that everything had to be in black. It so happened that I had worn only summer clothes to Madison, and I had white shoes. So I had no other alternative than to go to commencement with white shoes on. At that time, they had the custom of your major or a member of your major department bringing you down and presenting you to the president before the large crowd. I was always very proud of the fact that Professor Ogg, very busy man that he was, took off the day to come and present me to the president. Oddly enough, as I walked down where Dean Slichter was standing, I noticed he had on white shoes. One other little observation on the commencement that day, as we were lining up for the academic parade, the governor was present and President Frank was lining people up. And he said, "Governor, you walk over here on the left." And the governor went the other direction. And President Frank said, "Nobody will ever make a left winger out of you, will they, governor? You go over here on the right." This was a great day in my life. I was the only one of the candidates for the PhD degree in political science who attended the commencement. Lee Green, who had become a very close friend of mine, did not finish his work until August, when he took his oral, and I do not believe that he appeared at commencement. John Lewis did not appear at commencement either. I would remark one or two other things about my experience in Wisconsin. Immediately after getting my doctor's degree, I entered law school because I still had a glimmering that I might practice law. So I went over to the law school the day after to attend the first class with Dean Rundell, and he wanted to know where I was the day before that I'd missed class. And I explained to him that I was at commencement, and he forgave me. This was one of the most valuable courses that I ever had. I had law professors at Harvard and Kentucky and other places, but Rundell, I would list as one of the two or three greatest teachers I ever had. In the week before commencement, we had the farewell Friday night for Professor John R. Commons, who was retiring that year. And I remember the feeling we had of what a tragic experience he'd had in life. He had lost his family, his son had disappeared, finally to be found some years afterward. His wife was dead. One of his daughters had died. And during that very summer, a sister who was living with him was killed in an automobile accident. Commons then went on to Florida and lived in a sort of a motel. I think that it was something of a disgrace to Wisconsin that they did not provide for retired professors better than they did, because the retirement benefits were not very good at that time. One other thing, when I was living in the dormitory with the undergraduate students, I recall one of the students going over and getting his grades, which were not very good. And he came back and he said, "I'll head for Alabama next year." That was a contrast between the two institutions. One other experience that I had with the undergraduate students, some people had been cheating on an examination, and they believed that the grading was done on the curve system. So he went and reported this cheating because he figured that it would lower him on the curve in the grading system. My associations with these undergraduate students were very, very pleasant indeed. although I was in the graduate school and they were some freshmen, we had some congenial meetings in the dormitory. The final comment on the experimental college was delivered by Alexander Michaljohn at the student union in saying, and his final comment was, that to get a liberal education in America was impossible because American institutions would not allow people to have the freedom that was necessary to have an actual liberal education. That about it.
Thank you.
This completes my student experiences, although I didn't return to the university for law school work in 1935. And there I attended the funeral of Belle K. Slopalop at the end of the summer of 1935. I had some conversations with Professor Goss, but these are something that should come in a later discussion of my relations with Professor Goss and the University of Wisconsin Graduate School. The most illuminating conversation in 1934 or 1935 that I had with Professor Goss involved his relations to the New Deal, and particularly the TVA. And I'm sure that he was instrumental later on in my appointment to go to the TVA in 1936. He had spent the year before in Europe. And he had returned to visit with his wife's family in Maine in the spring of 1933, I suppose it was. He had barely gotten to Boston and gone up to his wife's family, and they lived in rural Maine, that the telephone rang. And as he explained to me, there was a terrible storm going on, and he was not happy about talking on the telephone during this storm.